book here. So, let us begin with
Prometheus. Paul, you didn't cast the Prometheus girl at the very beginning.
Oh, that's right, yeah. A little Prometheus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I was playing Fuffa Father.
No, you're playing Sophie Banks. That's
okay.
Different.
It has to be the same. You can use the same person for that.
Yeah, it's just, she's just a little girl. She doesn't have much to say. You know, so, okay, so here we go.
I'm ready with the Promethea puzzle. But
alrighty.
Are we ready?
Yes.
Promethea puzzle, an adventure in folklore. Then to that diamond-beaded glade there came a pageant throng of imagining, of fairies, imps, and creatures without name, a great frenetic bustling of wings. About their queen, four nymphs in waiting stood, girded in armor, each of beauty rare, cowslips and flax, and Jenny in the wood, and sweet Promethea with her plaited hair. With these lines, some 50 stanzas into his epic sentimental fantasy, A Fairy Romance, New England poet Charlton Sennett, 1751 to 1803, makes his first mention of a character who has since then evolved into a fascinating literary mystery in her own right. Promethea, a handmaiden with skin like polished betel wood, is introduced as one of the four handmaidens to the fairy queen Titania, a straight crib from A Midsummer Night's Dream, to which Sennett originally intended his own poem as a tribute. But within a dozen or so stanzas seems to have completely taken over both the entire poem and the poet's imagination. What starts out as an idyll with Titania and her fairy entourage at play in some Arcadian backwater of the natural world is quickly sidetracked into a long narrative that details an intense and, for the period, passionate romance between the nymph Promethea and a mortal shepherd lad with moon-calf eyes, in whose poetic nature one suspects Sennett intended an extremely flattering depiction of himself. Sennett, from such few descriptions of him as exist, appears as a somewhat unpleasant man whose wife left him abruptly when she learned he had seduced a simple-minded servant girl in their employ. From there, the tale becomes more grim and sordid still, although nothing of any substance could ever be proven. Afterward, Sennett would seem to have sunk into a deep depression, ending only with the poet's death from liver failure at the relatively early age of 52 years old. All this is a far cry from the moonstruck and sensitive young shepherd poet that's described in Sennett's narrative, and yet one can't escape the feeling that in the unblemished innocence of his male lead, hopelessly in love with an immortal being from the land of Derry, Sennett was describing himself as he wished he had been. His poem, overlong and often plodding in its rhythm, can almost be seen as a protracted and idyllic sexual fantasy in which Sennett sought solace from the bitter circumstances of real life. The fact that in the first years of the 20th century, both Sennett and his work were in effect unknown makes the next incarnation of Promethea something of a puzzle to the modern literary historian. In 1901, in the Sunday Color section of William Randolph Hearst's New York Clarion, a comic strip both drawn and written by the artist Margaret Taylor Case, commenced a lengthy run that lasted until Case retired in 1920. Little Margie in Misty Magicland was a sometimes saccharine but more often genuinely charming and inventive fantasy about a little girl called Margie and her strange adventures in the daydream world of her imagination, the Misty Magicland of the strip title. Here she would encounter fairies, centaurs, ancient gods, and characters from folklore, such as in the memorable extended serial which depicted Margie helping to depose a jack who'd grown tyrannical and taken over the enormous beanstalk kingdom previously inhabited by giants. Sequences including Margie trapped inside a giantess's sewing basket with its monstrous cotton reels and tape measure showed off Margaret Case's deft ability at conjuring a dreamlike atmosphere by playing with the size and scale of things, and made her comic strip a minor legend in its field, still studied by aficionados today. Case claimed that little Margie was in fact herself as a child, and that the infant's curious adventures in quaintly named regions of Misty Magicland, such as the Splendid Strand of Yawn or Dogworm once fuming Paris, were no more than the cartoonist's childhood wanderings in the realm of fancy, transformed almost verbatim into a comic strip. If this is so, then it would seem that Margaret Taylor Case was not aware of the Promethea in Charlton Sennett's poem when she introduced a character of the same name and of a very similar nature to her cast of cartoon players in the fall of 1903. While lost in Baron Firebluff's chuckling orchard, Margie is eventually rescued by a brace of characters that would remain her companions for almost the rest of the newspaper strip's duration. These were a benign and often motherly fairy princess named Promethea and a regrettable comic relief sidekick named Chinky the Chinese Imp. Chinky, a grotesque and demonic racial caricature complete with pigtail and gibberish dialogue, moo-foo-boo, while obviously offensive to contemporary audiences, was hardly out of keeping with the outlook of the time, in which racial minorities were cast routinely as degrading comic stooges and buffoons. Chinky can never be said to have developed as a personality during his lengthy tenure in the strip. The same is not true of Promethea. As Case depicted her, Promethea emerges as a brave, compassionate figure with what at times would seem an almost melancholy air about her. In her earliest appearances, she patiently explains to little Margie that she's had and lost a daughter of her own and feels a great attachment to Margie as a direct consequence of this. There is even one sentence, puzzlingly out of character and never subsequently mentioned in any later episode, where Promethea grows angry and resentful of little Margie's periodic returns to her natural family in the real waking world. "Don't you think that I'd like to go there with you now and then? I had a father once myself, you know, when I was a real little girl." This bewildering outburst is never explained, but it serves to indicate the level of complexity and intrigue that Case brought to a supporting character with only a minor role to play. Promethea's exit from the strip, some several months before Case opted for retirement in May of 1920, is just as striking and as mystifying. Announcing that she's tired of people and their warlike ways, she says farewell to Margie and embarks, Chinky in tow, upon a journey that she says will lead her to a kingdom of her own. What kingdom this might be is not remarked upon, nor is her statement properly explained, when in the 17 years of her stay in Little Margie, she has seen no warfare and, other than Margie herself, very few examples of what might reasonably be called people. After Promethea's departure, much of the life, imagination, and enthusiasm that Case had invested in the work seemed to have departed with her. 6 months of pallid and lackluster stories followed before the cartoonist, sensing that the work had lost its magic, put away her brush and pen and settled for a retirement that was comfortable and uneventful. The Promethean trail grows cold for a few years until the pulp boom of the 1920s, when again we find a character of that name and with certain common traits appearing in a serial narrative. Once more, it would appear as if the various creators who would engineer Promethea's next incarnation did so without knowledge of Charlton Sennett or the background character that had appeared in Little Margie, although obviously the latter cannot be entirely ruled out. This Promethea was the lead figure and the heroine of an occasional series of short fantasy novellas that appeared in the acclaimed pulp monthly Astonishing Stories, starting in the issue dated February 1924. Other than in her name and in some details of appearance, this Promethea is very different from her earlier namesake, being both a fierce and amorous warrior queen constantly fighting to protect her lost fantasy land of High Rathil from various devilish and monstrous invaders, all originating in the demon-haunted territories beyond the country's boundaries. In the first published tale, A Warrior Queen of High Rathil, we find the plucky outlander Promethea as she fights her way up from foot soldier to become the sovereign ruler of the vast and marvelous domain. Credited, as were all subsequent Promethea stories, to Marto Neptura, this tale portrays Promethea as a sexually knowing woman with a string of lovers in her past and a ferocious skill with swords and axes. In fact, Marto Neptura was as non-existent as Promethea herself, being merely an invented house pseudonym under which a great number of nameless hack writers churned out what were usually, it must be said, both uninspired and uninspiring potboiler narratives of the spicy fantasy school. here follows an example from Promethea and the Manigators, oh boy, the eighth story in the series. The rivulets of blood on her brown arms were like scarlet lacework, fitfully illuminated in the staccato and infrequent dazzle of the lightning. With her firm breasts heaving, the beloved queen of High Brasil forced her reptilian antagonist closer and closer to his edge. His terrifying jaws snapped tight together only inches from her face as, with the muscles standing out on her long, tawny legs, she heaved the alligator creature into the abyss below. Clearly, the fact that the Promethea tales in Astonishing are still remembered fondly and are indeed quite collectible is not based on the literary merit of the story. It's interesting to observe that both the poet Sennett and the nameless author of the Manigator's yarn describe Promethea's skin as tawny. In actuality, the enduring popularity of Marto Neptura's Promethea had nothing to do with the mythical Mr. Neptura and everything to do with the legendary Grace Branagh, a pulp cover illustrator with a style that's been compared to near-contemporary Margaret Brundage, who provided painted covers for some 50 issues of Astonishing, including all 15 issues in which the lead story was a new Promethea novella, creating a firm bond in the reader's mind between the artist and the heroine. It hardly comes as a surprise that almost all the articles since written on Promethea in the pulp have focused on Grace Branagh's contribution, leaving the actual stories and their content virtually ignored. Branagh's Promethea conceals a number of intriguing elements beneath a pulp veneer. The cover illustrations, in their luminous depictions of the continent of High Brasil, portray a world that's hauntingly surreal and alien, with shifting metaphoric rock formations beneath a swirling emerald sky that could never have possibly existed on our world, for all that the interior narrative insists that High Brasil is a real continent in Earth's primordial past. It turns out that the continent of High Brasil was once considered to be real, and is indeed depicted on the shipping maps of only a few hundred years ago. In many ways, it would seem to correspond to paradise or even fairyland. Celtic mythology named High Brasil as Nag, the fairy kingdom. Oddly, this almost brings us back to Sennett's vision of Promethea as hailing from the realm of fairies and folklore. In 1938, the publishers responsible for Astonishing Stories were bought out by a group called Apex Magazine, who mostly published comic books. Combing through Astonishing's inventory for characters they might successfully transfer, only Promethea seemed to have any possibilities. And so, in 1941, the character's fourth incarnation made her debut as lead feature in Apex's Smashing Comics, later graduating to her own book titled simply Promethea, 1946. This new Promethea, while loosely modeled on the pulp incarnation, was recast as a science heroine of the type at which the company specialized. Thus, Promethea now operates in contemporary America, fighting crooks, spies, and the Nazi menace. She has an FBI man as a boyfriend, Dirk Dangerfield, as your service princess, and only returns to her other dimensional kingdom of High Brasil for occasional adventures. The artist writer for these stories, working on the strip from 1941 to his tragic violent death in 1970, was former classics teacher William Wolcott. Wolcott was an intensely private man who many later feminist critics of comics have applauded with some reservation for the genuine female sensibility with which he imparted to the character. Following Wolcott's death, Promethea was handed to a young and radical new comics writer, Stephen Shelley, for a revamp, ably assisted by a number of comics artists, including a memorable stint, and I just lost my plea, hang on a minute here, by artist P. Craig Russell. The most noticeable change that Shelley brought to Wolcott's character was to change her skin coloring from firmly Caucasian flesh pink back to the polished betel wood of earlier incarnations. This was almost certainly because, by Shelley's own admission, he was basing his Promethea upon his lovely and vivacious Hispanic wife, Barbara. Shelley brought a great deal of intelligence and fondness for experiment to his depiction of the character, and his death from cancer in the spring of 1996 led to a suspension of the Apex Comics series in a gesture practically unheard of in the industry. Cynics, of course, were quick to point out the declining sales of the title as the actual motive for its cancellation, as apparently it's well known that books with a female title character have never performed well in the current male-oriented marketplace. So today, Promethea is in limbo, or perhaps the magic land, with her adventures no longer for the public. Given the current popularity of simplistic postmodern characters such inexplicably celebrated Sleeping Gorilla, perhaps it's simply that time has gone and that there is no longer a place for the romantic fantasy and play of the imagination that Promethea represents. We can only hope that she is merely resting in some corner of the realm of fairy or of high Brazil, and that in the future she'll turn up in a new guise, some fresh twist of puzzling history, a genuine piece of American folklore in action, of poetry in motion. Alan Moore.
Well, fantastic. That was wonderful. You went red. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, and now I have no voice.
Right. Chapter 1. A voice pleads in the desert. A dread shadow laughs in the city. A desperate student writes the truth. Promethea. Alan Moore, J.H. Williams III, Mick Gray, and Todd Klung. If she did not exist, we would have to invent her. Alexandria, 411 A.D. Well, then, there is nothing for it if there are coming for me, as they came for beautiful Hypatia. Blessed go now, beloved daughter. All my love and all my goods shall be about thee as a mantle.
Father? Father, would you be killed? I know it. Oh, Father, oh no, oh no.
Be strong, child. We shall see each other in the western lands. And go now, my love, or I shall weaken. Go!
She runs.
All right.
Come out, you devil worshiper. Come out and face us.
He's playing some trick. My thoughts are all queer. No, we must ignore his bewitchments. Let's go what we came here for.
He is playing some trick. My thoughts are all queer. No, we must ignore his bewitchments. Let's do what we came here for.
In Christ's name, make him stop. I'm going to be sick. Take that devil. Our thoughts are our own.
In Christ's name, make him stop. I am going to be sick. To take that devil. Our thoughts are our own.
Again, dear God, let this be done with. See, he is yet smiling. There, time claims him, time and the radiant heavenly city.
Again, dear God, let this be done. See, he is yet smiling. Hi there. Time claims him, time and the radiant heavenly city.
Narrating
New York, 1999 A.D.
You are dropping off where? Sophie! Not another interview for your term paper. I had mine finished like weeks ago. You're totally gay.
Oh, you slut. Weeping gorillas complete.
No. You're saying, yeah, well, you're fat.
Yeah, well, you're fat. If my term paper was a discourse on Weeping Gorilla, I'd have finished it weeks ago.
Oh, you slut! Weeping Gorilla is completely the best! I mean, what was your paper on again? Prostitutia? Prosthetica?
Promethea. The same name turns up in 18th century poems, early newspaper strips, pulp magazines, and comic books. That's interesting. Weeping Gorilla's just pointless.
There is no point. That is the genius of Weeping Gorilla. Who are you interviewing?
Weeping Gorilla says, choke. Modern life makes me feel so alone.
Her name's Arthur Shelley. She's the widow of the last guy who wrote Promethea comic book. Actually, her address is right near here if you want to drop me off.
Hey, guy, he'll be fine. Then you can run me over to St. Mark's place.
You're going to the limp gig, huh? You know, Stacia, this Shelley woman sounded like she's sort of a bitch on the phone. Given the choice, I'd rather be out with you tonight.
Ah, you want my body, you homo. Admit it. Listen, I'll see you in college tomorrow. Good luck finding out about prolapsia.
Promethea. Mrs. Shelley? I'm Sophie Banks. I called last week about my paper on Promethea.
Barbara Shelley?
Who's doing Barbara Shelley? I'll do Barbara Shelley. Oh, you better come in.
Thanks for seeing me. You must get lots of people asking about your husband's work.
No, nobody. That's why I figured I'd better check you out. Listen, why are you interested in Promethea? On the phone, you said something about folklore.
Right. See, the name Promethea goes way back. She's first mentioned in this poem, a fairy romance written by someone called Charlton Sennett in 1780. She's not a warrior in the poem. She's this fairy handmaiden.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then in 1901, the nearest syndicate runs this newspaper strip, Little Margie in Misty Magic Land, by Margaret Taylor Case. Margie has this sort of fairy companion named Promethea.
So there's a coincidence about the name? How's this folklore?
Yeah, well, see, Little Margie ran until 1920. Now, during World War I, a popular story arose in the trenches about a warrior angel appearing to soldiers in need. She called herself Promethea.
Ah, half those guys had shell shock.
Wait, it gets weirder. In 1924, this pulp magazine, Astonishing Stories, runs a series, Promethea, Warrior Queen of High Brazil. This Promethea rules a science fantasy lost continent. A woman called Grace Branagh does some great covers.
Listen, where's all this going?
Astonishing Story, Fall, 1938. The publisher bought a company who then turned Promethea into a science hero comic. This guy, William Wolcott, writes it until 1970 when your late husband takes over. Meanwhile, there's all these urban legends about people meeting Promethea.
Miss Bangs.
Look,
I've been having second thoughts about this interview. It's late and I'm tired, suddenly real tired. If I was you, I'd drop this whole Promethea thing right now. It's a nothing idea, you know? Now, if you'll excuse me.
But my term paper.
Listen, kid. You take my advice. You don't want to go looking for folklore. And you especially don't want folklore to come looking for you.
I don't believe it. Just like that. Out in the cold.
Alexandria. 411 A.D.
Father? Father, it's getting dark and I'm scared. Father, Father, please don't be dead. Please, please. I don't know where to go. Woo, down, down she goes. land. Daddy? And is a kind of salamander, huge salamander, reptilian figure in front of her. Daddy, you said I'd be all right. I'm all on my own, Daddy. Please save me. You said there'd be gods. You said they'd look after me. You promised me, Daddy. Promise.
New York, 1999 A.D.
Oh.
Hi, ha. Sorry if we startled you. We were there, young lady. But please don't be alarmed. This is purely routine. Kenneth, we had one of those psychic flashes about you. You're not being menaced by strange, overwhelming forces by any chance. You may recognize us. We're New York's resident science heroes. Five swell guys, and we're just out to patrol.
Sorry, Beth Pittman.
Has left the conference.
Yes.
Oh, I'm having a lot of problems with completing my term paper. But, you know, that's all.
Hmm. And so no extraterrestrial creatures bothering you? No governmental conspiracies? Ancient demon cults? Nothing like that? Kenneth, you've been a little off since your divorce.
This interview I was doing didn't work out, so I was headed over to St. Mark's Place to see this English band, The Limp. My high-toned is a failure.
Heck, you know, I felt so sure. Come on, Kenneth, you were sure that Betty wasn't sleeping with...
Has arrived.
We're sorry to have bothered you, Miss... Good luck with your term paper.
Sure, no problem. Bye. Waves. Wow, five swell guys. Wait till I tell Stacia. She'll hemorrhage. And the demon follows her up the steps. She goes to a place called L25. Something she sees.
Hello?
Oh. Oh, my God, Mom, Buddha. What did I do? I haven't done anything. She's running. I'm a college student. All I ever did was read books. What did I do? Down, she goes, past the sign that says, wrong books.
Wrong books. That's the spiel.
God damn it.
Okay.
You can fly.
Promethea Barbara's coming in here, so I guess that's you, Johanna.
Okay. Ruff. God damn it. And then...
Oh, you can fly.
Can I hell?
Weeping gorilla, go on, ask me about my marriage.
where are we now? Climb up me onto the bridge, for Christ's sake. You think I can hang here all day?
No. I mean, I'm climbing.
Come on, hurry. That shmi is gonna be all over us.
Please don't. I don't know what's happening.
Don't worry. Don't worry. I'm on it. Okay, you creepy son of a bitch. Come on. I dare ya.
Oh, no, don't.
Open you like a fish.
Oh, God, leave her alone. You'll kill her.
No, he won't.
Wow,
you killed it.
The shmi? Don't be stupid. It's just winded. Come on, let's get out of here.
Where are we going?
Well, I don't know. Just somewhere where we can hide up and delay the inevitable. Jeez, that thing cut me good. Whoa.
They're walking through an underground passage, it looks like.
Brr! There, that ought to do it. She kicks in the door. Okay, maybe it won't find us for a while. Christ, I must be nuts getting into this at my age.
Look, what's going on here? Who are you?
Who am I? Ha ha ha! Well, that's a good one. I'm friggin' Promethea, you idiot.
She looks idiotic.
Right.
Alexandria, 411 A.D. Don't be afraid. You were lost, but now you are found. Now everything is well.
Are you one of my father's gods come to keep me safe?
No, I am a two of your father's gods. I am Toth Hermes, and I cannot keep you safe, not in this present world.
Why not?
Our influence here is waning, our priests slaying, and those of the new god, a dark age is coming. Only in my world, the Immateria, can I protect you, and there you will no longer be a little girl. You'll be a story.
Would I still be alive? Would I be able to come back and visit this world?
You would live eternally, as stories do. As for coming back, well, sometimes, if a story is very special, it can quite take people over. We'll see. Come along.
Is your world very far away?
No, it is always in the place where you are standing. Tell me, child, what is your name?
Promethea.
And they go into the distance.
Okay, now we have a narrator's thing. Who would like to be the narrator for this?
Well, see, Promethea was a real little girl who lived in the 5th century Roman Egypt. Her father was a Hermetic scholar, sort of like a magician. A Christian mob killed him. Not uncommon back then, but the gods intervened, taking his daughter into their world of myth and fiction, the Immateria. Promethea became a living story, growing up in the realm that all dreams and stories come from. Sometimes she'd wander into the imagination of mortals. Charlton Sennett, the poet Margaret Case, the cartoonist and Grace Branagh, the illustrator and comic artist William Wolcott, and writer Steve Shelley. They channeled Promethea. Some of them taken over by the powerful living idea, even physically became Promethea. Either them or loved ones that they projected their identity onto. Margaret Chase, for example, became Promethea to help out in the trenches of World War I during the 20s and 30s. Grace Branagh took over. See, anyone with imagination and enough enthusiasm for the character can bring her through from the Immateria, but thinking themselves or others into the role. During the 1770s, Charlton Sennett, housemaid Anna, became his dream lover, Promethea, transformed by the poet's imagination as he wrote the fairy romance for her. And there's a whole bunch of beautiful illustrations of times gone by and the inspiration of the archetype of Promethea. Steve Shelley did the same thing, only with his wife. Okay. Continue.
Oh, my God. You're the woman I tried to interview. You're Barbara Shelley.
Kid. Is that... Kid, I pray to God you're not as dumb as you act. Yeah, I'm Barbara Shelley. Guess it's showing. Can't maintain the form, you know. See, it was my Steve had the imagination. He died. 91. Since then, Promethea has been getting more like me. Can't imagine her any different.
You changed back.
Boy, you're sharp as a tack, ain't you? I can't believe whoever sent that Shmee thinks you're the next Promethea.
Me?
Well, ain't it obvious? They must have sensed it as soon as somebody even became interested in Promethea. I told you, you thought I dropped it.
I can't be Promethea.
We'd better hope otherwise. We got half an hour before that Shmee finds us. Do you write?
Well, essays and poetry and stuff, but...
Take this. Go find somewhere quiet and write about Promethea. A description, a poem, anything. And do it quick. A Shmee is a semi-mindless elemental entity. It's probably rape, kill, and disembowel us. Maybe even in that order. Oh, and try to relax.
Sure.
So now we have Promethea, Sophie, writing away. So you want to share with your thoughts, Promethea?
Her name was... She's writing on her pad, Promethea thou art. She scribbles it all out. I am Promethea. And take my name. From tied bound to a rock and plagued by birds, in me burns his... She writes heavenly, crosses it out, celestial, stolen flame. I am the word made flesh, the flesh made words. I am Promethea. My father slain, crossed out dead, martyred, his bones dabbed black, crossed out red with heresy, by those who would turn gold back into lead, and some and sour a world, crossed out with by their sour alchemy. I am Promethea, God's adopted one, reared in their immaterial hills and veils. My tale is in the world of substance spun, yet is my substance in the world of tales. I am Promethea, the child who stands between fixed earth and insubstantial air, a thought who yet treads matter's rain-swept strands. Immortals are the sandals that I wear. I am Promethea. From mind's pure light, I stoop into earth's gloom, from fable's day descending into fact's cold, weight, night, from the lyric atmospheres to mammal clay. I am Promethea. The rumored one, the mythic bough that reason strains to bend. I am that voice left once the book is done. I am the dream that waking does not end. Oh,
that's supposed to be me. Okay. To set it up, the Shmee is getting closer and closer as Promethea is writing this.
Actually, that's Promethea, Sophie.
Right.
Says, I bring you fire. Mm-hmm. Whereas Promethea, Barbara, is still lying down on the ground.
Right.
Self things. And the Shmee says, I'm too late then.
Did we skip a page?
I think you skipped a page, kiddo. Yeah, because I have
Oh, but, I did. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have to go. The Shmi has opened whatever doorway and...
I told you. I'd kill you. Where's the girl?
You're wrong about her. Whoever's talking, she's not the one. She just doesn't have it. Leave her be.
Not what I asked. Where is she?
Ah! Who sent you? Is it the temple? Is it Jack Faust or the Night Queen? Oh, God, I'm telling you, the girl's not the one. She's some useless kid. She's nobody. She's...
I am Promethea, art's fiercest spark. I am all inspiration, all desire.
Oh, God. Oh, jeez.
Imagination's blaze in mankind's dark. I am Promethea. I bring you fire.
Oh, I'm too late then.
Much too little.
What did you have for breakfast?
I'm much too late.
Bad sausages.
Barbara, I must get you to a hospital.
You were incredible. You were better than I ever was. Hell, you were better than Grace Branagh.
You've lost a lot of blood. Don't try to talk.
But I got so much I have to tell you. There's so much you need to know. You need to know about your predecessors. Margie Case and poor Bill Wolcott and the rest. You need to know your enemies. It was probably the temple who sent the Shmi. Then there's the Immateria.
Hush, there'll be time to tell me later when you're well. Now that I'm back, I have all the time there's in the world. Time. And the radiant, heavenly city. She embraces Barbara. Behind her is Moore's House of Magic, the Weeping Gorilla, and next comes the Judgment of Solomon in Chapter 2,
which will be next week.
Excellent.
Are we going to do a hermeneutic on this chapter?
Yeah.
Oh, let me go get my tostera. I don't usually have it. Right. Yeah, let me go.
Oh, well. Let's discuss what's going on. We're obviously getting set up for something here, but what's going on in this chapter? And, there's actually a lot of information background information to digest or to try to put in your imagination.
Right.
But what do you think?
It's like a repeat of the introduction,
mm-hmm.
or the prologue.
Yeah.
But it made it a little more personal,
right? Right.
Yeah.
You know what's creeping me out? I had so many synchronicities with this. I'm coming to the end of Daniel Trussoni's Angeology.
Oh yeah, that's a fun book. Yeah.
Yes, it is. And Prometheus and Rockefeller Center figure highly towards the end, and I'm just reading about that, and then boom, we're starting Promethea. And then I had gotten something about the unicorn tapestries,
mm-hmm.
the cloisters, and that figured towards the end of Angeology as well, so there were all these synchronicities. And of course, they explain briefly.
Well, I wonder if Promethea will come into our dreams tonight.
That's interesting, too. Yep.
Yeah. Do we know who the little girl's father is back in Alexandria?
As far as I know, he remains unnamed.
His wife is very famous. Hypatia.
I didn't even know Hypatia was married.
Well, no, she. I don't think it was his wife. I think the model of.
He says that.
He just says they are coming for me as they came for beautiful Hypatia.
Right.
He doesn't say that it was
his
wife.
How did he know she was beautiful? There were lots of young philosophy students who just were smite just to look at her.
I've always assumed that he was Hypatia's husband. He doesn't say my beautiful. He says they came from beautiful Hypatia. Yeah.
But in the there are a number of fictional versions of Hypatia. One was a couple written during Victorian. One was written by that name in Victorian times by a minor occultist. But he said. He said her. There was a big emphasis on her being a virginity.
Oh. Well, that's how the legend comes, the mythos comes down to us. Isn't it through the Christian tradition? All these women have to be virgins.
Another great comment about
pure widows or whatever.
Bertrand Russell. He talked about how, you know, the mob killed her in 450 or something like that.
Right.
And then he said, after that, Alexandria was no longer troubled by philosophers.
Pesky philosophers.
The triumph of the mob, just to kill the last philosopher.
Just dogmatic theologians.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
They're in the PDF. If you put in the search Hypatia, it brings up the life of Hypatia.
Can you tell me the URL for that? I couldn't find it.
Okay. Let me, you know what, I'll do something better.
Send it to me?
Yep.
Okay, thanks,
It's in the PDF?
Yeah. It's in the PDF and it's a URL. The PDF keeps the URL. Oh, it's 18 megabytes. I won't be able to do it.
In the notes there is
What I would do is, can you send Rachel the URL?
I found a link. There was a link in something.
Some of the links this website are broken. I didn't systematically check them all, but I checked several.
Well, what's the website, Paul?
The website, yeah. The PDF has the website as the first thing.
But how do I find any of this? where can I go to get to it?
On Paul's site.
Okay.
But I have a PDF
what's your
file.
Site, Paul?
That's in the email that I sent you.
Okay.
Taro Hermeneutics, and then they'll be right up in front. They'll take
TaroHermeneutics.com.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I'll go there. Thanks.
And then right in the front, that'll take you to the special page, and then off to the side will be the PDF file. And there's a few other things. There's a list of synopsis of each of the chapters. That's an author generated synopsis. I didn't write any of those.
I didn't purchase the $60
Absolute.
I had the 5-volume version from before. We even talked about Promethea. I had read it and bought it and all that kind of stuff.
The only reason to buy the Absolute Promethea is if you just love it so much. It's only about a third bigger than the original, and so in some ways, and it's only the first two of the paperback books. There's 5 paperback books. The Absolute only includes
the first two volumes.
They're gonna make 2 more volumes of Promethea. So that's a $300. Retail investment, which is a lot of money. I mean, I might like Promethea, and I might actually be stupid enough to buy the whole thing.
I mean, I love Promethea, but I don't know if I would spend that money.
It's not like the Sandman. The Absolute Sandman is really worth purchasing.
Oh, it's fabulous. Well,
they didn't do the same job on Promethea.
Mm-hmm. What's in the Absolute Sandman? That's different.
Yeah.
Well, what's different than the Absolute Sandman?
It's the whole series?
It's smaller. The basic thing is it's smaller. It's a smaller format. If it was as large as the Absolute Sandman, it'd be quite impressive, actually.
Okay.
It'd be worth the money.
Yeah, because I have the first Absolute here.
Yeah.
That's the only one out right now.
Yeah.
And the others probably will come out in a year or so. One of the things that Promethea won lots of awards for was for the strange color schemes that'll come up when we go through the Tree of Life, which is about 20 chapters in. Does anybody want to deal with any of the either character issues or...
I think we need to talk a little bit about Alan Moore.
All right.
The background is on the first, and I imagine all five, of my copies, is perhaps the most acclaimed writer in the graphic story medium, having garnered many awards for such works as Watchmen, V for Vendetta, which was also made into a movie, perhaps the others were too, From Hell, Miracle Man, Swamp Thing, and Supreme, among others. Along with the many fine artists he's collaborated with on those works, he's currently masterminding the entire America's Best Comics line, writing Tom Strong's Top 10 Tomorrow Stories, in addition to Promethea, and more in the planning stages. He resides in central England. And then they go on about J.H. Williams' background, the penciler and co-creator of Promethea, and Nick Gray, a longtime comics inker, they call him. His background is awesome. I didn't know that V for Vendetta came out before Promethea, for example.
Mm, that's interesting.
And then they have dedications at the back of the book with their pictures.
If I can say something about this?
Sure.
Please.
I know a fair amount about Alan Moore's work. Miracle Man, which is called... Marvel Man in England, was his first big breakthrough. And that he took the old Captain Marvel character and put him in the real world. It's a very, very powerful story. And I've reread it quite a few times. And then he did V for Vendetta after that, based upon Margaret Thatcher's reign as dictator in England. and then he did some stuff for DC Comics, particularly Swamp Thing, which actually was the launch of the sort of adult line of Vertigo horror comics, of which Sandman is the most famous, example. And he was sort of Neil Gaiman's mentor in the early days.
Mm.
Neil Gaiman would not do what he did without Alan Moore. And then Watchmen came out. And Watchmen was his, sort of his most famous work, his masterpiece. Yet they did From Hell, which is about Jack the Ripper, but it's really about Victorian society and the class system. And movies have been made from that and from V for Vendetta and Watchmen, of course. Every one of them Alan Moore denounced horribly.
Oh, really? Really?
He denounced them for all kinds of reasons, but he said about Watchmen that it was shite, which is, British for shit. And he said the reason it was shite was because the whole point of Watchmen was it was written for a comic book. And it was written for that medium. This is Alan Moore's whole thing, to use the medium to its great advantages. And to translate into a movie, just all they have left is the story. They don't have the qualities of the medium that were so special.
Yeah, and in some ways, that's one of the reasons why the movie... I actually like the movie a lot, The Watchmen. And actually, there is a way, if people haven't read Watchmen, I kind of recommend it, because in some ways, Watchmen and Promethea are complementary.
How so?
Well, they both represent a critique of superhero myths. Definitely, Watchmen... argument is from the point of view of male, where women are just sort of window dressing. Whereas Promethea is also a critique of the superhero, but it's also an exploration of gender issues.
It's the opposite in a way of Watchmen.
Yeah.
But Watchmen takes the superhero genre and deconstructs it by setting it into a very hard-edged real world.
Mm-hmm.
So it says, the basic premise of Watchmen is, well, if you had masked vigilantes running around doing things, what kind of people would they actually be? And the answer is more or less psychopaths.
Right.
And here he says, is the opposite. Here he says, behind the superhero genre is the power of imagination and the hermetic tradition. So it's like, going down in Washington, going up in Promethea.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, when I said complementary, I actually meant them in that contrast.
Yeah,
so they
yeah.
really represent very different visions of the world.
And I think Promethea has to be understood also in connection to Wonder Woman.
Oh, of course.
Because
yeah.
it's very much based on, people, when it first came out, people were saying in the comics world, it's Wonder Woman as she should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah, yeah.
That's fascinating, Rachel. Thanks. I mean, there's no way I would have known any of this. And it was my first exploration of a graphic novel, and Promethea the second. It's not a medium that I grew up with, or, maybe the Archie comics, that kind of stuff. But I wasn't even allowed to read comics.
I was a Justice League of America fan myself, but...
Uh-huh.
I read a little bit of the Fantastic Four. So
that's the Five Tall Guys,
right? Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, that can be found in Wikipedia. There's if you look up Five Swell Guys in Wikipedia, they give a little blurb on that.
I have to send everyone this site. This is Wildstorm. They have download podcasts of the artists and writers behind some of the great comics.
Yeah, Wildstorm is one of the DC things, isn't it?
Yeah. Vertigo Voices, The Fables Forum, Green Lantern, The Blackest Night. These are all podcasts. Wednesday, View of the Future, Batman, and New Dynamic. I'll send this off to Paul, and then he'll send it off to the list. I mean, if you're into comics.
Yeah, about Wildstorm and Alan Moore.
Yeah.
So Alan Moore was working for Vertigo, for DC Comics, writing Swamp Thing, And he finished doing it, and he gave it over to one of his friends, Rick Veitch. So Rick Veitch did a story in which Swamp Thing travels back in time to see the crucifixion of Christ.
Yeah.
And then he himself becomes Christ, crucified on the cross. And DC censored it. And Alan Moore was so enraged, he said he would never work for DC Comics again. He'd never write anything for them ever again, So he starts this series of comics called ABC, America's Best Comics, of which Promethea is one. There's about three or four others. And it's going okay, and he does it. He sells it, I guess, or has produced by Wildstorm. And all of a sudden, Wildstorm gets bought up by DC. So it's a huge issue, What would happen to America's Best Comics? So they made a kind of agreement that even though DC would actually own it, there would never be any mention of DC on any of the issues. The name of DC would never appear anywhere in Alan Moore's comics. But it's a funny thing about the history of it.
The irony.
He's such a principled person, Alan Moore. With Watchmen, all the money that he would have gotten for it, which is a huge amount of money, he gave to the artist, Dave Gibbons.
Wow.
Because principally against it, he wouldn't make any money for it.
Yeah. I do have... by the way, if you go to the... I think I've got it someplace, the fan site for Alan Moore. I tried to get in touch with him to the point of at least letting him know that this thing was happening. That's very hard to do. This guy doesn't want to be bothered. And there are hundreds of thousands of fans who all want to, for various reasons, bother this guy. I'm sympathetic with his reclusiveness. However, he does some interesting things. He does performance work.
Does he really?
In the kind of stand-up performance, ad lib, spontaneous stuff. And he also apparently has some kind of band he occasionally feels with. Some of which you can see video casts of if you go to YouTube and/or you go to his fanzine. Where they have a couple of these things available to look at. So
he's very multi-talented.
Yeah, but I guess the next thing we might want to touch upon is his orientation towards the occult, which this is his. He really wanted to. The one way that I read about Promethea was this is where he wanted carte blanche to explore. In a full way, aspects of the Hermetic tradition as he had studied it, which is probably a Thelemite. In other words, it's probably is that the way to pronounce that? It's probably Aleister Crowley.
That seems pretty definite. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a practicing magician. You know, it's not something just that he studies.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he not only reads about it and thinks about it, but he imagines it, but he'll act it out, you know.
I wonder if Lon has any connection with him, or that guy, what's his name? He's on Ning. He's a practicing magician, an artist also.
One of the other classic occultists who had a great influence was Geiger, R.H. Geiger.
Was Geiger an occultist, really, or just an illustrator?
It's hard to say. I don't know enough about him to venture an opinion on that at this point. His stuff on Alien and
I know his artwork and Necromunon. His Necromunon was something. Aye.
Yeah.
Oh, Gregor. Yeah. That's where I sort of was going to go with this. The illustrations. I'm sure you've heard this before. Certainly not all tarots, but many tarots, even ancient tarots. Marseille tarots, the Italian tarots to a certain extent when they're more in the Marseille vein, all have a certain comic quality to the figures, bigger than life, the proportionality is a little off, the colors are vibrant, limited and vibrant.
Mm-hmm. So, well, they're supposed to put you in an altered state.
Right.
I think comics do that, too.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they wouldn't have the fan base that they do. I loved my comics. You know,
Which one did you read as a child?
Oh boy, I read. What did I read? Batman. I read. I remember Batman. I remember Superman. But I liked Batman. Duh. I wonder why.
I liked the old Batman comics from the 40s, the very, very early ones.
Yep.
I had an older cousin who had, all of them.
Wow.
And I sort of inherited them from him. And, I liked the older ones.
And the Fantastic Four. I had such a comic book collection.
Okay.
My sisters did also. We had some first editions, and my mother wouldn't let us take it. To our new home. I don't even go there. You know, I don't even want, every time I cringe.
I'm right there with you, Johanna. We had one in particular that I remember. It was a Justice League of America.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The first edition.
It was a particular issue where these beings were drawing down the moon from the sky, and the Justice League all had to change, use their powers to look like they were somebody else. And it was just, it was a, I think it was called One Hour Till Doomsday. I have recently looked that up online, and issues of it are selling for $600 and $700 now.
Yeah.
And it's like, it went out in the trash, you
mm-hmm.
know? And I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But I loved it, you know? I mean, I loved the story. It was really cool, so.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, parents, what do they know?
Okay.
Yeah, right?
I know. My mother threw them out.
Yep, exactly.
That was the name of the store.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was, the one story about this, which is slightly related, was when I was, I guess in third or fourth grade, I got the first issues of Famous Monsters of Filmland.
Oh, yes.
At the local.
That was one of my favorites.
But unfortunately, some friends of mine at junior high stole them all and chopped them all up for a political campaign.
Okay.
which is too bad, because those first issues of Famous Monsters of Filmland go for a little bit of money these days.
Yep.
Wow.
I used to I was a fan of Forrest Ackerman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And
recently.
Yes, he did. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things about secrets, and when I think of what was the name of the occult organization that you had mentioned, Paul?
The OTO?
No, not ODO. It wasn't ODO. It was another one that Alan Moore belonged to, or comes he.
Well, the Telemite.
The Telemite.
That is the OTO.
That is OTO. Okay.
Yeah.
When I think of, organizations with secrets, et cetera, and their members, here's a man whose whole life, his art, is dedicated to communication. You wonder how much is hidden in plain sight, so to speak, in the comics.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, throughout the graphic novel or comic genre, how much is right out there in plain sight?
That's going to come up a lot. We're going to see, interesting occult secrets are going to be pointed out in blatant and very obvious ways.
I am so grateful to Promethea, the Promethea series. I've never been able to get any kind of grasp of the 11th Seraphot, that is not a Seraphot, dot. And here in Promethea, it's very freely spoken of and explained simply.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, they travel through the tree. You know,
right.
That's,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, but they don't ignore Dot.
No, no, they travel through Dot. Dot is a major issue.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So,
it's like
a really, I think, major contribution to an understanding of the tree in general. Promethea does a great service, and just think of all the readers that it's had in the past and continues to have through the life with the new volume one of a series that's going to go out to even more young people. So. And adults, of course, their parents. And that's an interesting idea. Who is the audience? Is the audience a child for Promethea? Is the audience, you know, young adults, college students? Who is the audience? Who was Alan Moore thinking of? Who is this?
Well, it's definitely adults. It's not kids.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And probably, I suppose, you know, I guess his primary audience is probably around college age.
Mm-hmm. I know my niece Andrea just sat down and devoured the volume, book one here of The Absolute. So it is.
One of the problems the comics world has is that it doesn't have child readers anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I remember like a good 15 years ago being told that the median age of comics readers was 42.
Wow.
Which is one reason why so many contemporary comics are nostalgic. Kind of reference to, you know, comics from the older decades.
You know, Rachel, that's interesting. I find our entire artistic culture in this country, probably throughout the world,
has that sentimental, backward, revisionist look predominating, taking stories that were popular in our parents' generation and grandparents' generation, perhaps through graphic novels and whatnot, and reconstituting them, re-envisioning them.
Mm-hmm. Also, some TV shows are very graphic. I mean, now...
Oh, totally.
No, Fringe and Supernatural, and they would be great graphic novels.
Yes, they would. And I have the pleasure sometimes of catching up with them on Hulu, is it?
Mm-hmm.
And it'll stop. There'll be a short pause at every take. So you do get a graphic novel sense. Very, very much so. What do you call the little boxes?
Panels.
Yeah. You get that feeling of panels, one after another, moving along at a slow clip when you watch it on Hulu, at least raised on my machine.
It's well known that a lot of action movies have been based using storyboards.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Right out of comics.
Yeah.
Which the idea came from comics, exactly.
Yeah.
So which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Does Alan Moore write out his story and the artist?
Alan Moore writes out, he writes what's called a full script, which means he describes every panel in meticulous detail.
Right.
The website called comicbookscriptarchive.com.
Okay.
And they have the first few pages of Alan Moore's script for a comic book, a graphic novel about the Joker he did for DC Comics, a Batman story. And for a proposal I did for my college, I printed out the text for page one of the comic runs to 8 single-space pages.
Wow.
Yeah.
Page one.
Alan Moore and Neil Gaiman are very famous for their very dense, complete scripts, of, you know, saying what's on the table, what's in the corner of the panel, you know, the body postures, etc. There's another way of doing it, though, which Marvel Comics does, in which the writer writes a synopsis, the artist draws the action, and the writer puts in the dialogue.
Right.
But Alan Moore,
I like the way Alan Moore and Gaiman do it. Those are the two graphic novels I was attracted to before I even knew anything. I hadn't grown up with this medium, and I was instantly taken. Sandman, I have everything. I have like 3 different collections, one for myself and one for each of my sons.
Wow.
And Promethea was the second to grab me.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there is something that seems to be true, definitely true of Gaiman's work, and definitely also true with Moore's work, though. Moore's work tends to be... sort of, there's a self-depreciation, depreciatingness aspect to it, where Gaiman's work, in a way, is intricate in that way, but also, but it's more what I call really deeply bound to the imagination, or the and the technical sense of the word of the imagial, and that's an important concept. Of course, here it's called immateria,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, is questionable. I don't know to what degree the imageral world of imagination and symbol. Basically, the thought is, and this is where Tarot comes into this picture, at least partly for me, is that images precede words. And images are the, you could say, is the the scepter or the of words, so that when you have an image, you have, you know, 1,000 words, right? You know, the classic taking from that Chinese adage, one picture is 1,000 words, The thing here is that this is why with tarot readers, you don't necessarily stick with the words that you learned around the tarot. The words, as they were, are there to help you unlock the image. And if you eventually become aware of the image will release you into a variety of associations, many of which you wouldn't necessarily even think of before. because we're actually not in, you know, a visual image where you're seeing the world in a perceptual sense, but you're in a conceptual image in which the image is reaching into deeper levels of meaning. And I think in this level, it's it unifies. It goes right down to the instinctual level of the brainstem and also goes into the most highest reaches of abstraction and is an image like that.
There's another important factor on every volume. There's a Promethea image on the cover, and as well as bars of intricate artwork and Hermes, Cardassius. But not to be glossed over, the fact that she does not have, she has just white for eyes, like all of the Sacred Rose Johannes.
That's very good. Yeah, very true.
I was wondering if
Well, yeah, well, I have always found that one of the things that takes a figure from one world to another is the eyes, or lack of pupils. You know, even in the film, when you see people with blank eyes, you know that there's a different energy about them. I mean, they're in the physicality, just like any human being, but the eyes are blank. So, I stand by my cases that I could not, I know how to draw eyes. I've taken figure painting, you know what I'm saying? I've taken portraiture. I know how to draw eyes, but when it came to doing the tarot, I could not do it. I could not put eyes in the figures.
Maybe you weren't supposed to.
Exactly. Yeah. It was an energy force. That's all I can explain. I'm nuts, whatever. You want to say I was psychotic. I had a moment of whatever breaking with reality, but it's true. I couldn't do it.
Well, you know, it may be that actually that Alan Moore and J.H. Williams were influenced by the Sacred Rose Tarot.
So, that's possible,
because, you know, Alan Moore is a tarotist, so he might very well have had the Sacred Rose Tarot and been struck by the idea of the blank eyes. And in comics, of course, the most famous blank eyes are Little Orphan Annie.
Little Orphan Annie.
Yeah.
Go back to the immateria for a second. The immateria sort of is like Jung's collective unconscious.
Yes, yes.
Except that it's more real. Later on, when they start to go to the Tree of Life, it's revealed that the immateria is a part of Earth. It's not in any of the higher realms. Mm-hmm. She describes it as Earth upper level, like the attic. You know. And so you travel from, you know, the material world to the immateria, but the immateria is still part of Earth. It's not part of any of the celestial bodies, which is kind of interesting.
You know, it just suddenly hit me. It's like the third eye of Earth.
That's a good analogy.
Well, one of the things with the lack of a pupil, or the lack of the eye, or the white, or just the white of the eye, is that like the inward turning eye. You know, the classic person in trance. Eyes, their eyes, their
pupils roll back in their head.
Roll back, yeah. And this is a way of saying that this, that with the Promethea and Orphan Annie.
And Batman, too. Batman has no eyes.
Yeah.
But it's funny, in the film, in the film version, the eyes are the most intense thing.
Yeah,
those eyes
are.
Behind the, his mask.
Yeah.
They really make a statement.
Yeah.
To the character. Eyes are very interesting. Study of eyes in literature.
Part the black around it, you know, the mask holes are filled in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the skin is blackened around the eye. And
right.
I think the eyes look even more intense.
What's so interesting is all of the actors hated wearing the Batman costume because there's no peripheral vision. How in the world is this guy going... They were like horses with the blinders on, you know.
Well, there he had to use his third eye, you know. He couldn't see.
How he fought off all those villains that were coming from his extreme right or extreme left is a miracle.
The force, you know. The force was with him, yes.
Do you
we'll mix our mythologies here.
Yeah.
The Promethea gallery at the back of your book?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really, for artists, I think it's like so amazing. And we were talking about no eyes. When someone has a seizure, very often their eyes do roll back in their heads. And here, the staff of Hermes, the Caudacious, is sort of depicted as an electric kind of force.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, you know, all these references to the head and the eyes, the brain, and the brain being an electrical, our bodies being water and electricity, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the vital elan. You know, I don't know where I'm going with it, but other than Alan Moore certainly addresses it almost on every page.
Well, actually, let's
a picture of Alan Moore in the back.
Yeah.
He has no eyes.
You know, you're right.
you can't really see his back, you know.
The way they're
the reset.
If you look at the picture of J.H. Williams and the picture of Mick Gray, their eyes are very apparent.
Yep.
If you look at the picture of Alan Moore, his eyes are like you can't see them.
And you know, on the inside of the back cover, the black and white version of that, it's even more pronounced.
I at this point, what I'd like us, at least one of us, somebody who's got a deck handy.
I have the Toth.
The Toth. Just give it a little shuffle.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do, and just one person needs to do this so that we don't have 500 interpretations. And eventually we'll all do our draws from the Toth. But just let's ask or ask for a commentary from the Toth Tarot. Of what we've been discussing. In other words, this is our first thing, so just leave it as a kind of open-ended issue and see what it addresses.
How many cards do you want?
Just three.
First card is Aeon.
Ah. Very interesting.
Which is the world card. Am I correct? Yes, it is. Yes.
It's Aeon is the...
Judgment. Okay.
Then,
second card is... Now, I did shuffle this deck. I did. The universe.
Oh,
I did shuffle the deck.
All right, we believe you shuffled it. This is the, you know, we have to, you know, come on, people, you're all tarot readers. Serendipity goes with the terrain.
Okay, and the next one, are we doing reversals or not?
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Okay, Three of Swords.
Okay.
Was it reversed that you drew?
It was reversed, the Three of Swords reversed.
Okay, comment quickly about the Universe card, which is, you know, the final card of the Major Arcana.
Yeah.
And Moore follows the, you know, scheme of the Golden Dawn and Aleister Crowley, and refers to the Universe card as Route 32. It's an actual road traveling between, the upper levels of the tree and Malkuth, the physical world, Earth. And is issue 8 or something like that when Sophie Promethea meets the William Walcott version of Promethea,
right.
And they're driving this little car on this actual road. There's a road sign that says Route 32.
Ah!
Mm.
Yeah.
So that universal car has that quality of being the connecting link.
So, you know, in some ways also, the Aeon represents the judgment, and that way it represents the beginning.
Yeah. And you have Toth right there.
Yeah.
And it does represent the beginning, which is what we're doing. The Universe card says that we are obviously going into this universe, not only this Promethea comic universe, but we're also going to use it to explore in a sort of light way. The Toth Tarot.
And the higher levels of the tree of life. Yeah.
Yeah, the higher levels of the tree of life. So that we got these two very prominent and also very, very sort of, completion-oriented major arcana.
Say something about the judgment.
question about the Eon card in this deck. It's actually its beginning, because it's the new age. It's the shifting of the age from Pisces to Aquarius.
Yeah.
So it's also said that the book, in a way, is part of that shifting of consciousness.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, something else about the Aeon card, too, just looking at the imagery, because I don't work with the Toss deck much, so, you know, I'm not familiar with what all the symbolism is. But just looking at the imagery, it's transforming one being into another, so that's very much connected with the whole Prometheus thing.
Though you decided to call it Aeon instead of Judgment, I think that what they're doing is it is the kind of transformation that takes place in the Judgment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, transformation of one level to another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're the celestial Earth. Again, it's just said. Then we have the Three of Swords reversed, and I don't have a deck in front of me. What does that look like?
Well, you have.
Okay, sorry.
Oh no, go ahead if you want to speak. Go
I was going to say. It has sort of a murky green quality. Imagine satin or organza, black and green, being crunched with the sword in reverse, sort of going through, I believe, what is it, lotus?
Uh-huh.
At the heart of the lotus, and then a bent sword. Because we have two hilts to the sword that's bent, we get a sense of two swords. And the reverse dagger-like motion into the heart of the lotus.
They are all piercing the very center.
Right. Absolutely.
And it's Saturn in Libra, the sign, the sigils of the planet Saturn, and in Libra, which may be also the planet, you know, the aspect of the card, but it's...
How would you read the top reversal of this card? I don't use this deck. I don't use reversals.
Okay, let's see. We got the book here.
A PC Tarantino. She is a tarot reader in California.
She has
a tarot for a new Aeon, practical guide to the power and wisdom of the Toth Tarot.
Okay.
It's a non-official. You know, there are some that go very much into the stick closely. She's a little more thing. So she says Three of Swords inverted. She says that calls attention to the soap opera that you called your life is in the process of becoming less intense. You seem to be more and more exhausted lately by what transpired. Ask yourself, am I willing to integrate what has occurred and to move on? Memories belong to who you were. The present belongs to who you are. Enjoy your life while you create a new and more exciting history.
Wow. That goes so with Aeon. And
That's why I thought I would, and I'm only reading little pieces of her interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
That is very interesting.
Her grasp of that card, I mean, it's just so yes with the, you know, in concert. Whereas I thought, my goodness, you know, it's like kind of a tone shift.
Yeah.
Of the other two, not so.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Well, I think that one of the things that may happen in our study of this, besides just the pleasure of it, I think one of the things it will do is it'll open us up to appreciate more the Toth Tarot, get us away from if some of us are still, crawly phobic, we might get a little less. We did have a number of serendipitous things I mentioned in the thing. The first broadcast in 80 years of The Magician,
mm-hmm.
the silent movie The Magician, which was
which
Crawley claimed. Somerset Maugham never said that he based it on Crawley. Crawley claimed it in Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
And what is the free league?
Good as poor press.
Yeah, well, yeah, he was at that point in his life, he was interested in any press.
Right.
This circa 1908, you know. So then, some 20 years later, you know, there's this quite elaborate movie, which also foreshadows what Frankenstein's laboratory looks like and 5 years later when the first Frankenstein movie comes out. But I thought that was kind of interesting that this the story, it's a Svengali story of the magician, and, comes out, you know, the week before we're doing this thing as a tribute to Uncle Al. Well, he's looking down on us, you can say. Or looking up at us.
Yeah, right.
I think he looked down on a lot of people. I'm not so sure that's a distinction, you know?
Yeah. Well, we're in good company then. And then, of course, Mother's Nature's storm. blowing things anew.
I would be interested, because I have a story that I sometimes tell about, remember Jane Roberts and the Seth series?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
I met Seth without knowing I was meeting Seth. I picked up Jane Roberts' book at a bookstore, and I didn't open it. I didn't look at it. I just put it on the shelf, and that night, I had one of the most vivid dreams ever, and I went into an antique shop.
In the dream?
In the dream, one of these musty old antique shops, and there was a man in the back, behind a desk, an old roll-top desk, and sitting, and and I said, "Who are you?" And he goes, "I'm Seth."
Oh, wow.
And then I go over, I wake up from the dream, and in a cold sweat, I go over knowing that it was really an astral occurrence that happened, not a dream, and I go open up the book, and there's a picture of the guy I met in my dream. So now I'm wondering, I think we may have a Promethea experience.
We may. Maybe one of us is the next incarnation of Prometheus.
Yes, that's right. I'm looking forward to becoming Prometheus.
I don't know if the cop
my voice will get a little high.
I don't know about incarnation, you know, but
Mistress Paul, just like the Walcott became Mistress Bell.
Yes, that's right.
I think Paul may have a little problem with the wardrobe, but, you know.
You'll see how it can happen.
I will.
Now we know what to expect to see you dressed as at the Reader's Studio, right?
That would be great, Paul.
That will be great, yeah. If I can get a bustier, that'll work.
She'll call Madonna. She probably has something she could loan to you, yeah.
Actually, what she said at TheaCon some years back, and there was a costume thing, and there's this woman who was absolutely Prometheus. She did everything.
Oh, my gosh.
Tattoos. It was just...
Oh, my gosh.
And nobody recognized her but me, which was really sad.
Oh.
She did all that work, and most people just didn't get it, you know?
Mm.
Probably thought she was Wonder Woman or something. Yeah.
Didn't know what she was. Didn't know what she was doing.
Yeah. Oh, that's a shame. I can't believe it.
The costume, the headdress, the drawings on the legs, you know.
When was this?
Well, I do recommend that we that in terms of our initial reading, that it's actually quite profound. We'll keep a record of the cards we draw.
Uh huh.
As well as anything else that comes up.
What the title word is on the Three of Swords?
The title?
Tara.
There is no title.
That book I read from?
Yeah.
No, on the card there's a word.
It said sorrow.
Sorrow, okay.
Oh, yes, yeah, sorrow. Oh, yes, yeah. Well, it's usually called Separation and Sorrow. The Lord of Sorrow.
It's like getting past sorrow. It's like to a higher level of understanding of our world.
Also, there is what I would say is like the sword is piercing the lotus, which means I think knowledge, getting to the heart of a situation.
The sword is truth.
It has,
you know, it's clarity.
Like, in reverse, it has a grail-like, I'm sorry, is it Arthurian more than grail? But it's like a sword in the stone.
Yes.
Kind of feeling, even though a lotus in reality is not a stone in the image, it has a hard quality, sort of like a stone-like quality.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the new, well, relatively new deck, the fifth tarot, the lotus is representative of the fifth element of spirit. And mm-hmm. so I see here truth very much piercing spirit. In other words, spirit is opening up to truth and clarity in this reverse three. So, who knows? We may just become so clear we just can't stand ourselves.
Well, it may give us the sense, give us a greater sense of objectivity towards the astral world. I think in a lot of ways, a lot of what we're going to learn about is the nature of immateria. And which is another way of saying the imagination,
sure,
writ large, and that's what we use when we read the tarot. Well, thank you. I guess there's no reason for us to go to noon unless. But I just really appreciative of everybody. I know it's not necessarily the easiest time. in a day to be able to get there and do this thing, and I appreciate you making.
Well, we appreciate you for pulling it together.
Oh, mm-hmm. Paul, this is such a good idea, and very grateful.
Yeah.
And all the material you put together, wow, a brilliant job.
Yeah. Well, it was done out of love, and you know, basically, what it does is it also fits into my orientation, which is to recognize that tarot meanings will develop reflexively in the tarot community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that this is part of. It's the conversations we have here and what we learn here will go deeply into any kind of tarot reading or tarot decks that anybody eventually creates or does.
Yeah. I think Prometheus is really valuable for tarot people to read.
Mm-hmm.
Because not just of the Tree of Life, which is certainly, when I did a book on the Tree of Life, I used Prometheus as one of my sources.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For understanding it. But also because of the whole idea of, you know, the immateria, which is so important to tarot. That the imagination is a real place and that the things in it are real.
Yeah.
And that the
The people we're talking to, some of them, you know, just don't realize the power of their own imagination. And
that's what
we have to alert people to.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the Aeon card, I always get a feeling of Kali Yuga.
The end of Kali Yuga.
Yeah. I think there's an apocalyptic sound to Aeon. A-E-O-N.
Well, we do know that one of the myths of Promethea is that she ushers in the apocalypse.
Oh. Yeah,
that the world actually comes to an end in this.
There's actually a bit of background on that. So when Alan Moore launched Promethea, it was part of the America's Best Comics group.
Right.
So he had the Promethea Top 10, Tom Strong, and then a little collection of rotating stories. And they were all linked, even though they didn't appear in each other's stories, they were linked. It was like what was called in the comics world a universe. You know, so you had the DC universe, the Marvel universe, now you had the ABC universe.
Uh-huh.
And Moore announced that he was going to end the world. And, you know, in comics, there's always these dangers of the apocalypse, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just like in the Buffy television show.
Right.
There's one apocalypse after another, and they always manage to survive. Mm-hmm. They always stop the world from ending. So Moore said he could actually end the world. And he implied that not only would it end in Prometheus, it would end in all the comics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Prometheus is going to be 32 issues, so there's 32 paths for the Tree of Life.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, he would end this entire universe, the ABC universe, would be ended by Prometheus. And so that's what a lot of the storyline's about. And for those of you who have not read it yet, I won't tell you what actually happens.
I do have to point out, you know, I don't mean to be specious, but the Caudacious is also a very important medical symbol. And here we are in the midst of this tremendous warfare over our healthcare system. Certainly, it's an issue throughout the world, not only here.
Yeah.
We're aware of our own. And according to Nostradamus, please correct me if I'm wrong, but according to Nostradamus, people who are specialists in that area, he claimed that our civilization would be brought down by concerns with spending money for health.
But I think he said it was 1992 would be the year of the apocalypse.
He was off by 30 years.
That's
20 years.
1992 for that reason.
I see something very interesting in the Aeon card here, is that the transparent figure gives the sign of silence.
Horus is the new age.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like the child, giving the sign of silence, right?
Yeah.
Apocalypse, yeah.
He's sort of tucked in the womb of all these aeons.
Mm. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Waiting to be born.
The new age is not being spoken yet, it's silent. Right. I think you made a comment about the caduceus and the medical profession.
Yeah.
That's actually a mistake, because the medical profession symbol really, they were thinking of the staff of Asclepius.
Right.
Which is one snake.
Right.
Okay. Two snakes is always with Hermes.
So there are two, and I'm thinking of another one.
Well, my point is that the medical profession does indeed use it, and so when Promethea saves Barbara Shelley,
right?
And she brings her to the hospital,
right?
They said, I don't remember if it's the end of one or the beginning of two, but she says, Barbara, says, well, we even recognize a modern hospital. And Promethea says, some symbols are timeless, such as the symbol for wisdom. She doesn't say healing, she says wisdom. Because there's a caduceus on the side of the hospital.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, but she speaks of it, of course, as a symbol of wisdom, not of healing.
Ah.
And that's really what it is, the caduceus. It's the symbol, it's the kundalini symbol.
Yeah, right.
It's the two strands of kundalini wound around the spine.
Right.
Or as we're going to learn, Mick and Mac.
Mick and Mac, right, yes. But the fact that the Greeks had that symbol, perhaps early on, is an indication that the Greeks understood the concept of kundalini.
Uh-huh.
Because it's such a graphic image of the
skull
is the spine, and the two snakes are Ida and Pingala, the two strands of kundalini that are wound around the spine.
Also in Egyptian art, you'll see that there's a crown that's worn in which a snake or an asp is coming out of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not actually where the third eye is, it's just above the third eye.
Yeah.
And
the seventh chakra?
No, actually, yeah. It was it's a part, considered an adjunct to the sixth.
Yeah, I did a version of the caduceus in which you cross the stick seven times, and then you can map out the 22 cards of the major arcana on that.
Oh, fine.
If I find it, I'll photocopy it and then send it to anyone who sends me their address.
Okay.
Sure, or just send it to me and I'll pass it along.
I could scan it. I suppose I could just do it, scan it, send it to people electronically, too.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, I'll take a look and see if I have that. I did have it. But
there's a lot of pictures of someone having intercourse with an old man in the back of it.
That's me, Jack Faust. That's a character I've got dibs on.
Yeah.
Like I want to be at least a dirty old man in fiction, if not.
All right, we'll indulge your fantasy. Yes.
So the comic.
And this was pre Viagra, too, no less.
So, Rachel, historically, the comic genre and the graphic novel genre and some of the TV shows are apocalyptic in nature. I'm finding that to be the case. I'm not a big TV watcher, but what I do, I watch a lot of film, though, from Netflix. And everything seems to be getting less sexual, more violent. In popular culture?
I think that there is I have this thing about women being victimized in any cultural aspect.
Yeah.
Even though I like my thrillers and things like that, I always have a hard time when it comes to that.
I think our generation grew up with Nancy Drew, and we just weren't going to take it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
But with all of the Saw series of movies.
Oh, that.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Oh, God.
Those are horrible on so many levels.
Yeah, so many levels.
And I know several young people who you would never believe would be. That is, they're acting out their darker selves and their darker consciousness through the Saw series.
Wow.
But, actually, there's something I read by a political scientist years ago that says that popular images of horror reflect political reality.
Mm-hmm.
And the Saw situation is where a group of people are held captive and then tortured and terrorized. You know.
Mm.
All the way through, and where there's basically no escape, you know, only fictitious escapes that lead to greater terror and horror. And, you know, this is kind of different if you go back to just a generation ago where it was Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was your dreams that were getting you. The person still had some autonomy and still had the ability to move away. A different kind of horror, which reflects on our greater society in terms of
the inexcapable
nature of a fear. Yeah, nature. Well, nature, political reality. We don't feel we have any power politically at this point in our mass consciousness.
And
of course, as tarot readers, we all know that there's a great deal of power.
Yes.
To reframe the world in many ways.
Well, the question that comes up with Promethea and also in tarot reading is, you know, do the images create reality? And tarot readers are always saying, oh, no, because, you know, we don't want to have that sense that people feel they're controlled by the tarot cards. But, you know, in Promethea, there's a really strong sense that imagination creates reality.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah,
I think it creates...
Very, very much so. That in some ways, I think that we should be a little more honest about the power of recreation.
Yeah.
Well, why do you think two of us, I know, said we shied away from the Crowley Toth Tarot? I have several of them, but I don't, they're not the cards I bring to the reader's studio, they're not the cards I read with, they're not the cards I give as gifts. They're just, you know, I find them dark.
But see, I find them dark, but I also find them, they're beautiful.
They're beautiful,
mm-hmm.
Yes. I mean, there's almost, it's almost a painful beauty to them, to me.
Right.
And
intellectual.
Yeah.
If I look at the Crowley deck, I feel like I have to study everything before I can look at use them.
Yes, that's it. I feel a little intimidated by it.
Right.
Well, the other thing is you can just go with the flow of the images. One of the things that I want to do.
I can't imagine putting them out in front of a client.
Well, is if you take the, I call them the ley lines. These are, you know, that's how you have all these strange lines that lead to
geometry. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, if you take those and you extend them beyond the card, you know, to, you know,
mm-hmm.
and move them around and play with them this way, you get a sense of what they were doing with. What it does is it'll help you see the multidimensionality of the thing. In some ways, I'd personally like to see. The deck done where some of the aspects of it were more crisply
you know,
portrayed.
Mary cuts off this entire border.
Yeah.
And I do have to say, without the border, the cards do come alive, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Well, that's the reason why I'm also suggesting.
Yes, it was many decks, but it was particularly striking. You know, I thought, when I looked at my top, boy, this is a deck that's crying out.
I think that's probably why I'm suggesting taking those ley lines and moving them beyond the border and
into
like another sheet of paper and stuff. It's an interesting exercise.
Or even don't match up the cards if they do.
Now, when you're talking about the lines, Paul, I'm sorry, maybe I'm just not seeing those. You're not talking about the border design itself.
There are circular dimensions, and there are also and there are also straight ones to come up in varying.
Much as I have to say, I continue to have an initial kind of leeriness of the deck. It is stunning. That said, there is no deck for me that has brought the core cards as alive as the Tops. The core cards, I think, are just amazing.
They're very real. They're very
amazing,
dynamic.
Amazing. We're at
noon, which is our usual ending time. So anybody wants to say goodbye now, this is a great time to say goodbye. Any closing words anybody wants to share?
This is wonderful. I've had a great time. Look forward to next week.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks again, Paul.
Thanks, everybody.
Okay. See you next week. I'll speak to you next week, rather. Okay. Bye-bye.
Tell all your friends who are...
has left the conference.
Bye.
Bye.